Great to have you with us on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. We're going to talk about Wisconsin's outdoors today on the show to begin it. Those of us who enjoy the Wisconsin outdoors generate a fair amount of money for the state, about $11.2 billion in 2023. And I don't think you can put a price on the quality of life benefits that come from getting fresh air and enjoying our wildlife and getting outside. And we're talking about that today with Cassie Mordini. Cassie is director of the Wisconsin Office of Outdoor Recreation. So as we talk with Cassie, I hope you'll join in. How do you value the time you spend on maybe hiking or boating or skiing or some other outdoor activity? Give us a call. The number's 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Cassie Mordini, welcome. Thanks for taking time to be with us today.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks so much for having me. Excited to chat outdoors. Love doing that.
Well, I tell you what, I think it was back in 2019, the Wisconsin Office of Outdoor Recreation was created. And at that time, I thought, well, isn't that what the tourism, the Division of Tourism does? But there's a, well, there, I mean, there's overlap.
Yep.
But there are differences. So maybe talk
Absolutely.
About the mission.
Yeah, happy to. And that is something that we've tried to explain over the last few years about what is different about the Office of Outdoor Rec that tourism isn't doing. And really the reason in Wisconsin, our Office of Outdoor Recreation is in our Department of Tourism is because there is that overlap and that importance of our outdoor product to tourism. It's one of the number one drivers for people visiting the state. So we need to ensure that not only are outdoor offerings top notch and continue to remain world class to drive that tourism, but also for the quality of life for our residents, right? We want to enjoy being here and take advantage of that. And it is also an industry unto itself driving our economy. Like you mentioned at the opening, $11.2 billion, over 97,000 jobs for Wisconsinites. It's creating that those vibrant communities. So our work really is to not only amplify outdoor recreation as an experience, a thing to do, a thing for travel, but also to drive that industry growth that's good for our communities and for our overall economy. And those industry stakeholders are anywhere from tourism attractions and to land managers, construction, building the trails and the infrastructure in which we recreate on.
It's a lot.
Yeah.
And we're one of several states that have recently created offices of outdoor recreation, are we not? And just you kind of wonder, why is it happening now?
Yeah, so Wisconsin was the 14th state to create an office back in 2019. The first state was Utah in 2013. So we really have been on the leading edge of this trend we're seeing across the United States. Today, there are 24 states, so about half of the states in the U.S. have an office or a governmental entity at the state level focused on uniting this and supporting this outdoor industry. Why, you say? Because there's a growing recognition of the economic importance of our natural spaces and the business that surrounds them.
It was interesting to look at the activities, popular activities of yeah. Wisconsin, and hiking and running on trails, I think, was was most often mentioned in some research, wasn't it?
Yeah, every 5 years, the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources has to complete what's called the SCORP, which stands for the State Comprehensive Outdoor Recreation Plan, and it assesses the supply and demand of outdoor recreation and then sets forth goals for the next 5 years. And as part of that, the demand, they do a survey of all the state residents and what activities are they participating in, how often, where do they go? And yes, walking, hiking, running usually trends as one of the top, if not the top activity. And I believe even nationwide, that's one of the top ones. If you think about it, it's probably one of the most accessible outdoor recreation activities,
yeah.
Least barrier to entry, right? You can step outside your door and go for a walk.
Yeah, even so, boating was up there pretty well. I think the 30.
Yeah.
So, well, we have a lot of lakes and rivers and streams. So that makes a lot of sense to me. And gardening, even about a third.
Absolutely.
Of
yeah.
Our people. One of the ones that surprised me was hunting wasn't as high, not even in the top 10.
Yeah, now that you mentioned that, that is a little surprising. Even so, it may not be one of the top ones when you look at the full population of Wisconsin, but Wisconsin still draws in a lot of out-of-state hunters and anglers because we do have a really robust white-tailed deer hunting and turkey hunting in Wisconsin. So we do draw, I want to say, over the last few years, Wisconsin has been in the top three, top five for out-of-state anglers and hunters.
It surprised me a little bit. Well, it worried me a little bit because a lot of our, at least on the federal side of things, the money that we can use for outdoor recreation comes from Pittman Robertson and probably as well, what's the other one?
Dingle Johnson.
Yeah. Dingle Johnson. Mm-hmm. So the fact that those are lower, it was kind of worrisome in the whole, because they're driving that. I mean, that money is driving a lot of, you know, what we like about the state, even if you're not a hunter.
That's true. Yeah. Those excise taxes go back into our conservation and outdoor recreation work. And so it is very important that there is a funding stream that helps us continue to maintain and improve our outdoor assets.
Yeah. What was intriguing to me was the outdoor industry side of things. And I'd love to know more about how you support the outdoor recreation industry. And, you know, here we're talking, we got such a broad range. I loved the little video that kind of showed the various businesses. But then how do you go about these gear manufacturers, the rod makers, the retailers, outfitters, and guides? That's a kind of a broad range. Mercury Marine. I mean, there's some big companies and all the way down to a guide.
Yeah, you hit the nail on the head there, Larry. And what is maybe unexpected about Wisconsin is we have dozens of world-renowned brands located in Wisconsin. You've probably heard their names before, but didn't know they were here. You might have named a couple. We've got Trek Bicycles, Pacific Bicycles. St. Croix Rod is the largest handcrafter of fishing rods in the entire North America. Bending Branches and Aquabound is the world's largest paddle maker. So they make canoe paddles and kayak paddles. They're located in Osceola on the St. Croix National Scenic River. We have all of these amazing product makers, and you might ask yourself, why are they here in Wisconsin? And they're not located only in metropolitan areas. No. They are dotted across rural Wisconsin too, right? I mentioned St. Croix Rod. They're in Park Falls, Wisconsin, a small community up north. It's because we have this outdoor product that's inspiring their maker. You know, the people that work there, they can also step outside, get refueled, re-energized. It's a part of their, you know, corporate wellness and health, that employee well-being that they can take advantage of in their time off and come back to work and channel that back into the work they're doing, creating, testing, designing the gear that we use when we go outside to recreate.
And how do you help those businesses? I mean, what does the office do?
Yeah, so one of the things we did from the early days of the office was really just trying to get a sense of who are those businesses in Wisconsin. There is no, there's industry coding for all businesses and organizations called NAICS. There is no NAICS code for outdoor recreation. So it was a very much a research-oriented project. Mm-hmm. And so we created an outdoor business directory to put all of these outdoor businesses and organizations in one place, and it's still an ongoing process to make sure that we're still finding them. Businesses pop up, they come and go, same with organizations. So we have a spot where we have them cataloged. It's a listing that's publicly accessible, so communities can even go in and look and see what outdoor recreation businesses are in their area. It serves as a hub for business owners to find their peers in Wisconsin. Who can they collaborate with? And so some of the things we're working on to build off of that business directory are creating opportunities for businesses to come together and meet each other. We are in the very near future going to be launching a business outdoor business needs assessment survey. So we'll be asking all of those outdoor businesses that we've learned about over the years to take a survey and help us understand, you know, what are their biggest needs and challenges right now, what's working for them, and how can the office work with other business support and development organizations or assistance that's out there to help level up what these specific outdoor businesses need.
Yeah, and I'm betting that you'll find there are some, even though there are quite different, you know, Trek Bike and Mercury Marine are different companies, but they may have surprisingly similar needs.
You're right. Yeah, absolutely. Workforce is a huge challenge right now for businesses across the board, not just outdoor recreation businesses. But outdoor recreation can be one of those selling points in attracting workforce. And so we created a tool for employers to use that showcases Wisconsin's outdoor recreation offerings, our culture, and the industry too, as a selling point when they are working to recruit talent from outside of the state. And that's available for free on our website. And we also worked with a handful of companies and communities to kind of tailor it to their specific locality or their company message, so it looks and feels like it's coming directly from them, but it's about Wisconsin.
Yeah, and I would think that could be all right. It's where St. Croix is located. St. Croix Rods is located is not a thriving metropolis, or, well, it might be thriving. It's not a metropolis, a large city or anything, but there are real benefits to be living in a place like that.
Absolutely. Yeah, and so that's what we're trying to capitalize on and utilize outdoor recreation as that selling point.
Rich in Madison has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Rich.
Yeah, good afternoon, or good morning, I guess, still. Larry, I love your show. I was just curious. Hopefully I'm not trying to cross too far a bridge here. I was just curious, as an inland trout fisherman, I think the DNR has done, you know, really positive things. I was just kind of curious about, is there any type of collaboration that goes on between the office of your guest and then, like, the DNR in, like, land procurement or protecting land that's already under, you know, certain restrictions or easements or whatever? And I'll, again, love your show, and I'll take my answer off the air. Yeah.
Thanks, Rich. Appreciate it. So, Cassie, you've got some things to say there, I'm betting.
Well, I would say yes, we absolutely collaborate with DNR and enjoy the opportunities when we have them to do that. In terms of the specificity of land acquisition, that's not in our purview as the Office of Outdoor Recreation. So that is something strictly in DNR. However, if we had a community come to us or an organization that was looking to working on a project and they needed to acquire land, we absolutely would refer them to our colleagues at DNR and some of the resources that they or grants they have available to help with that.
Yeah, that makes sense. You can't do everything.
Right? And why should we do something if we already have a state agency that's doing that, right?
Yeah.
Yep.
So, we'll give our listeners a chance to join in, by the way. The number to call again, 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@wpr.org. That SCORP survey, is that a statewide survey, or what? Or do we go out of state too or not?
It is strictly for Wisconsin residents. Yep. So that's in state.
And it's done, and the survey is done basically across the state.
Yeah.
Do you see conflicts coming up between, you know, we've got a lot of great outdoor activities, but then there can also be conflicts between, let's say, snowmobiling and ATV riding versus those who are the silent sports type, like hiking, biking, and paddling?
Sure. I mean, in any arena, right, there's going to be conflicts from time to time. But what I think is so great about the outdoors and in Wisconsin specifically, we've seen diverse user groups come together and realize that the cliche that high tides raise all boats, right? They understand that, and especially with the office being here and raising awareness of the importance of outdoor recreation overall to residents of Wisconsin, that if we're able to highlight one activity in a certain publication or whatnot, that it's going to have an impact, a ripple effect on all the other activities as well, because we can't always be everything to everybody at the same time.
Yeah. Yeah.
But we do try to make sure that, you know, Wisconsin does have a very diverse offering. We have a four-season climate, which makes snowmobiling a huge activity in the winter and absolutely an economic driver for communities where snowmobile trails are present. And those trails can be utilized in non-winter, well, some of them. Some of the public trails, a lot of snowmobile trails go through private lands, and that is a whole other undertaking that is really impressive by our snowmobile clubs every year.
Yeah, it's amazing. I've done interviewed some folks about that once, and the amount of effort and work and community relationships dealing with individual landowners, very impressive. Natalie in Menominee, Michigan has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Natalie.
Hi, this is a great show. Thanks for taking my call. And I'm wondering if you have a way to measure the economic impact of this outdoor recreation when some of these things don't, you know, you don't need a license to bike or hike or kayak or cross-country ski and that sort of thing.
Yeah, thanks for calling, Natalie. How do we measure the economic impact of non-motorized activities?
Well, I'm going to start with the big picture, and the U.S. Department of Commerce has the U.S. Bureau of Economic Analysis, and they have a satellite account for outdoor recreation, which measures the contribution of the outdoor industry to our gross domestic product, and they will dial down to the state level. So that's where we get that $11.2 billion industry figure is from the U.S. BEA. It does also then line item different activities or different sectors, so we can look at it that way, and that's a measure of the goods and services that add value to our GDP. But what it doesn't necessarily measure is like on that local impact, how you might say, how much money does the activity of biking on this trail bring into my community? Because we know when people come to recreate in our communities, they're not just going to go bike the trail and then head home. They're probably going to fill up their car with gas, grab a snack. Maybe they stay for dinner. Maybe they're planning an overnight vacation. So that spending that comes into our communities is all part of that economic impact. And the office created a do-it-yourself economic impact program last year that we piloted with five different community teams to actually go through the process of how do we collect that data, then how do we analyze it and calculate that economic impact for our community. And through the five different communities that participated, they realized collectively over $27 million in impact from the outdoor recreation that they were studying.
Which is a fair amount of money, and this is just five areas.
Yeah. So, for example, I know you're going to be talking shortly with folks from the Wausau area. Marathon County looked at the economic impact of Nine Mile County Forest, and found that out-of-town visitors to Nine Mile generated $3.25 million for Marathon County.
Yeah, that's a lot of money. You have, it was late June, wasn't it, where you have your first ever Wisconsin Governor's Outdoor Industry Awards.
That's right. We were so excited to recognize these folks this year.
Actually, one of our next guests, Bill Bertram, was the won the Big Ten Award, and his contribution to outdoor. Well, what was his contribution?
Yeah, so Bill Bertram is a real mover and shaker in the Wausau area and has been at the forefront of a lot of their outdoor recreation developments over the years and ongoing. And he's the Great Pinery Heritage Waterway, was recently designated as the National Recreation Water Trail. And as they implemented that water trail, he was very involved in making sure that it was accessible. So there are universal kayak launches throughout. And he's in everything Phil does there, he's just very mindful about creating that bigger tent for outdoor recreation and making sure that activities are accessible and welcoming for all.
And the Wisconsin State Park System, 125 years old this year, we've done some series on the state parks on this program just to highlight them. And it's been a lot of fun. The park system won the Destination of the Year Award. Maybe a coincidence that it's 125 years.
You know, they are truly like the crown jewels of Wisconsin's outdoor recreation offerings. And how fitting, right, on their 125th anniversary.
I wish we had some more state funding for it. State funding for State Park has fallen quite a bit since the 90s, 1990s.
Yeah.
And I'm hoping that our lawmakers will revisit and maybe increase support for the parks because they're sorely needed.
Well, as we see people continue to participate outdoors, I think that's a positive indicator of the importance of our outdoor spaces and our state parks in particular.
Yeah. So in the last minute here, what's your next big thing or what are you up to?
Well, I did mention our upcoming business needs survey. So if you're listening and you own an outdoor business, keep your eye peeled for that. Make sure you're on our email newsletter. If you're not, please find us on our website at outdoorrecreation.wi.gov and sign up for our newsletter. We're super excited. We're also, talked about the DIY Economic Impact Program. We have another cohort of five organizations that are going through that program now. So toward the end of the year, we'll have five new economic impact reports to share with folks and communities. We're just so excited to be also in the state budget this year. Wisconsin Governor Tony Evers and the Wisconsin State Legislature made our office permanent. So we are thrilled to be able to actually see to live out our five-year strategic plan that rolled out earlier this year. So really just excited to keep the momentum cranking and make sure that Wisconsin earns its well-deserved spot at the top of, you know, outdoor recreation destinations.
Well, you are a good representative of the organization, Cassie. I want to thank you.
Well, thanks, Larry.
Thanks a lot for being with us. We'll get you back and do this again. How about that?
Sounds great.
All right. Cassie Mordini is director of the Wisconsin Office of Outdoor Recreation. We'll post a link to the website on our page, but if you type in Wisconsin Office of Outdoor Recreation, I can guarantee it will pop up. Up next, we continue our conversation about outdoor recreation by talking about the Wausau area with our guest Bill Bertram of the Wausau and Marathon County Parks and Recreation Foundation joining us. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Many people know Wausau as the home of the downhill ski area Granite Peak. Cross-country skiers and mountain bikers have Rib Mountain State Park, and paddlers are welcome on the Wisconsin River as it passes through Wausau. It's also known as the Great Pinery Heritage Waterway. Larry Mueller here for WPR News, and we're spending the next half hour or so talking about all the outdoor recreation opportunities in the Wausau area with our guest, Bill Bertram. Bill is president of the board of the Wausau and Marathon County Parks and Recreation Foundation. So looking forward to talking to him. At noon, we'll talk with Chris Sweeney, who is author of the new book, The Feather Detective, Mystery, Mayhem, and the Magnificent Life of Roxy Laybourne. But right now, we visit with Bill, and I hope you'll join in. Have you spent time skiing or mountain biking or paddling in the Wausau area? Maybe you've competed in the Badger State Games or an Iron Bowl event there. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Bill Bertram, welcome. Thanks for taking time to be with us today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Larry, and look forward to it.
Well, here you are, a retired executive of a Wausau area manufacturing company, and now you're involved in promoting outdoor recreation there. How did you get so involved?
Yeah, you know, I've always had a tremendous love of parks and park programs. My uncle, Bill, was the mayor of my hometown, but he was like Mr. Smith went to Washington, but got me involved at a very young age in the park programs of my hometown. But the transformational event for me was my parent company moved me to the Netherlands, and I saw a different business model in the Netherlands that I had never seen in the U.S. And the Dutch collaborate on everything. And I came back with that idea of actually economic development. And I couldn't find a means or way to get there. And then I read an article in Forbes magazine on outdoor rec, why millennials live where they live. And I followed that train to Brookings Institute and a Pew study on millennial and Gen Zers and the importance of trailheads and outdoor rec to their lifestyle. They'll move to be within 15 minutes of a trailhead, and it's about play, work, and live in a community. And I use that to bridge into a passion for outdoor rec centered around economic development, which is like crazy, but it is what it is.
Well, it's a pretty good idea. And you said you're president of the board of the Wausau Marathon County Parks and Recreation Foundation. What does that foundation do?
Yeah, so, you know, there's a number of large counties in the state of Wisconsin that have foundations that work on small to mid-sized projects centered around parks. We focus on primarily the park system in Wausau as well as Marathon County. And we're a 501c3, and we've used that organization to do some real transformational projects in the greater Wausau area. The first one we did was outdoor rec organization, co-founded it with a partner called Iron Bowl to attract people to our area using our trail systems, our water, and all the green space we have. And the second one was really the Great Pinery Heritage Waterway, and which is another transformational project in this area.
It's absolutely amazing. And, you know, you look at Wausau, the area there is, I mean, just prime for all of those things.
Yeah, you know, the big vision actually happened here in 2018. When the Greater Wausau Chamber of Commerce hired a consultant from Bend, Oregon, and Austin, Texas called Tip Strategy. And they came up with a forward-looking 10-year plan for the Wausau area. And they knew that, you know, part was manufacturing and part was healthcare and part of it was education. They couldn't find the fourth leg of the stool. And as the story goes, the chamber chartered a plane for the consultant, John Roberts from Tip Strategies. And he saw all this water and green space, and he knew right away that was the fourth leg of the stool. And that he had something that the Wausau area had something that a lot of communities didn't have. You know, we have 28,000 acres of water in the county, and you know, tremendous amounts of forest land, and obviously Granite Peak was a huge draw in the wintertime. And he felt that we could leverage that to be not just a regional draw, but a national draw for people, kind of a mecca for people to come here and recreate.
That's working.
That it is.
let's talk about those Iron Bull events. You co-founded Iron Bull. You're vice president of the board. Talk more about what Iron Bull is.
Yeah, Iron Bull is a outdoor rec organization where we use the trail systems in a four county area of central Wisconsin. So we host races. We have the largest adventure race in the United States is held in the Wausau area. That's the Rib Mountain Adventure Challenge. We do gravel biking. We do paddling events, and we do ultra marathons. You could kind of think of us as the Ironman, but for outdoor rec. Everything from trail runs to gravel biking events, where we're using the amenities and assets of central Wisconsin to hold those events. And the importance of that is actually getting people to come here for events, and then hopefully back to that driver for me is to say, hey, I really like playing here, and you know, and then use that to leverage into working and living here.
Are the events for serious competitors, or can more, you know, a more casual runner or biker take part and have fun?
Yeah, that's the great thing with the Iron Bull events. There's something for everybody. For example, our gravel events, we have a family-friendly, kid-friendly 12-mile biking event, and then a 50-miler, an 85-miler. And then for the serious gravel rider, 144-mile event. And the same thing goes for our adventure challenges. There's a three-hour event for kind of introduction to kids and families for the recreational and the weekend warrior type person, all the way up to an 18-hour event for the serious adventure racer. So we, you know, the nice thing with our type of events, there's something for everybody. And for all members of the family, from just getting out and having fun to I'm a serious competitor and I want to compete, you know, at that level.
I'm more on the family fun.
That's two of us. Yeah, I'm quite old, so it's the family fun and the recreational writing's more for me.
Yeah. Oh, man. Bill Bertram, our guest today, president of the board of the Wausau and Marathon County Parks and Recreation Foundation, talking about all the great things going on in the Wausau Marathon County area. And I hope you'll join in with your own questions or comments or maybe experiences to share in that area. Give us a call. Number's 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us, the email address, talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Thanks so much for listening in today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. Just a quick mention, at noon today, we'll talk to Chris Sweeney, author of a great new book. It's titled The Feather Detective, Mystery, Mayhem, and the Magnificent Life of Roxy labored. But right now, we're taking a look at Wausau and Marathon County with Bill Bertram, who's president of the board of the Wausau and Marathon County Parks and Recreation Foundation, talking about all the things that are going on there. And I hope you'll join in. Again, the number is 800-642-1234 or email to talk@wpr.org. Somebody's wondering, you mentioned gravel bicycling, and somebody wants to know what the heck is gravel biking?
Yeah, so gravel biking is an offshoot of both road biking and mountain biking. And as people age out of mountain biking, they naturally transition into gravel. And the other driver for gravel is Wisconsin is blessed with just an incredible amount of scenery and naturalness to our gravel roads. And north of Highway 10, we're super blessed with a very special type of gravel up here, red granite. And it's a faceted stone, and it interlocks on itself and gives you compactness like asphalt. And these are old dairy roads and logging roads. So tons of scenery, tons of beautiful red barns throughout the area. And so for the road bikers, it's where they want to have a safer ride and be off road and see the scenery and the history of an area. Gravels is the fastest growing segment right now of biking. And last year in the U.S., it saw a 48% increase on gravel biking. And if you look at e-bikes and gravel bikes, they now account for the predominant share of bike sales. And so the e-bikes has really opened up the gravel roads of Wisconsin to be a real premier destination in the Midwest. We have the weather for about 9 months of the year, and the scenery and the fall colors and waterfalls and everything in between. So it's really an incredible experience for the rider.
I'm wondering how has it helped in terms of the economy of the area, something like that? Do you have sites where people can stop and naturally maybe get something to eat or drink or just learn about a particular feature of the landscape and so forth?
Yeah, so one of the things we started with the water trail was doing economic impact. And we coupled up with our local visitors bureau here in the Wausau area. And they had a very unique software program, Larry, called Zartico, where 97% of us leave our smartphones on, and there's GIS locators in those phones. So they're able to not know who you are, but know where you're at on a trail. So that was one of the real big advantages of the water trails, that we mapped it prior to putting the water trail in. And we've done the same thing for the gravel trails in central Wisconsin. So, and we've mapped the trails to the businesses along the trails, the amenities along the trails, where the trailheads are at. So we don't have to use trail counters anymore. We can use this software to actually determine the economic impact of a trail system, which is really unique. And that was a big idea that came from Cassie and her team. And so we collaborate, or I collaborate with her. I guess I can kind of tied at the shoulder with her, or at the hip, they might say, but the Office of Outdoor Rec and the Department of Tourism are awesome to work with, because they have these ideas. And I'm a data nerd myself, so I pivot around a lot of the help that they give us, and then putting us in contact with consultants, and we use those consultants to help define our trail systems, to drive it right back to how important this is to a community and to a business.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. My next question was going to be, how do you work with the Wisconsin Office of Outdoor Recreation? And you gave it to me without me even having to ask it. So it's a nice, it sounds like it's a really good collaboration.
Yeah, with Cassie, as you've listened to the first half hour, incredibly passionate about Wisconsin, and then some, and so you know, I always look at kind of my job is connecting ideas to funders and donors and foundations to make things happen, and. What Cassie provides is a conduit to literally hundreds of other organizations for me that I can contact to help with an idea. I'm a believer in benchmarking and looking at what somebody else has done. And it just speeds you to success. And between her and the department or the natural resources, the DNR, at the state level, work really close with them. And then I work with biking groups and user groups to kind of tie that all out. But yeah, she's just absolutely critical to us and to me.
That is very great to hear. You mentioned the Great Pinery Heritage Waterway. Tell us more about the waterway and first, how did you get it established? And I mean, the water was there, but it needed some help.
Yeah, so the idea of a head-to-toe trail in the Wisconsin goes back to 1987 with then Governor Thompson. Uh-huh. He had an idea of a state trail on the Wisconsin River. And then my very first meeting with the Office of Outdoor Rec, they actually put me in touch with a program within the National Park Service, their trails and community program. And we qualified for that. And the Wisconsin is really historic in nature. Maybe it's one of a dozen rivers in the United States that have that type of importance, right up there with the Hudson, the Potomac, the Ohio, the Mississippi, for what it meant for the development of the United States with the French influence early on and the white pine to the north of us. And so we worked with the Historical Society of Wisconsin, the University of Wisconsin, the local historical societies came up with the Great Pinery Heritage Waterway. And last fall we applied for national recreational trail status. And then June of this year, that was rolled up to the Department of Interior. And so we're the 12th national water trail in the state of Wisconsin. Two of the trails are scenic in nature. The other 10 are recreation. And so we're the last of that group. So, you know, one of 12 trails in Wisconsin that are national waterways.
And this is... what is it, 20 miles, almost 21
yeah,
miles?
Yeah, the total trail is 108 miles. We applied for approximately a 21-mile section of it for national water trail status, and we're in the process now of applying for another 35 miles from Wausau to the Lake DeBay Dam. And so over time, we'll continue to add to the water trail based on input from dam owners and communities. And our long-term goal is actually to go to the headwaters up on the Michigan border, down to the historical starting point of the trail, just south of Nakusa, Wisconsin, at Point Boss. And that was an 1837 survey that opened up the Great Pinery at that time.
Man. Well, on that 21-mile stretch, what kind of a paddling experience can people expect on the river there?
Yeah, so it's north of the Wausau area. It's a incredibly scenic. It takes you back to an ancient time when the river wasn't developed. The Wisconsin has the moniker as the hardest working river in the world because of the 26 dams, hydro dams on the river. It's also the most regulated river in the world. And so you can paddle it year round. So the north of us, it's really scenic, a lot of wildlife. I was up there paddling a couple of weeks ago and saw some bears along the banks, and a lot of osprey and eagles. And then it becomes industrial, which is part of our heritage. Mm-hmm. And what's unique about the river when we did the trail, not just in terms of geo mapping it, we also made sure that the trail had Wi-Fi compatibility along the whole trail. And this is a social world today, and social media is really important for people to do Instagrams and photographs to send to their friends in that moment when it happens. That was really important to us. And it also helps that we also looked at the trail in terms of accessibility. So we standardized on a special dock launch system along the trails, and the communities continue to put those in. So when we're done, we're hoping to have one of the first trails, maybe the only trail in the U.S. that's ADA compatible. So that it opens the waters to everybody on these dock launch systems.
It's an amazing story, and the effort there is to persuade. Maybe one of the efforts, I guess, is to persuade people maybe to visit or perhaps move to the Wausau area.
Absolutely, you know, we Mother Nature really blessed our area. You know, even within the state of Wisconsin, I mean, there's some incredible areas, La Crosse and Eau Claire. But when I visit those communities, they all tell me they wish they were Wausau because of Rib Mountain and Granite Peak in the wintertime. And then there's a huge initiative at Rib Mountain right now with the DNR to add mountain biking. Kind of winterproofs our economy up here. And we believe that'll be an IMBA Gold Center and a huge, it puts us on the level of a Bentonville, Arkansas in the Midwest.
That is very cool. You know, if people want to learn more about all of the things going on there, what's the best way to do it online?
Yeah, so our visit, Wausau, which is, they've rebranded themselves as Wisconsin's Base Camp, because that's how we see ourselves. Tim White and his team have put together just an amazing website on everything that the Wausau area offers the outdoor rec enthusiast.
And it's titled, again?
Visit Wausau.
Visit Wausau. I love going through that area. I remember suffering a little bit when I was on Grabar, biking that 500 miles from the top.
Bet you would.
And it gets a little hilly around there if you're on a bike, but it's beautiful.
Yeah, they don't. They think of Verona being the hills in the state, but yeah, we actually. Would give them a challenge for the hills we have in the area and just north of us in Brokaw. So, yeah, absolutely.
Especially some of those really steep ones.
Yeah. We've got them.
But there are a lot of, it's a wonderful place, Bill. And thank you for all the work that you've done on this. And thanks for your contributions. In the end, all right, we're looking for more people and so forth, but also we're looking to have people get outdoors and have a great time and stay
absolutely.
Healthy.
Yeah, absolutely.
We'll do it again, Bill. Thank you so much.
Okay.
Appreciate it.
Thanks so much, Larry. You have a great day.
You as well. Bill Bertram, president of the board of the Wausau and Marathon County Parks and Recreation Foundation. What a great guy. He's done a lot for the area and a lot for the state of Wisconsin. It was a pleasure talking with him today. Well, coming up, we're going to talk with the author of a wonderful new book. It's titled The Feather Detective, and the author is with us, Chris Sweeney, to talk about Roxy Laburn. I'm Larry Mealer. Great to have you with us on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. We're going to turn our attention to a book about Roxy Layburn. She was a trailblazing scientist. Her mantra was, do the work, keep your mouth shut, and they will respect you. And eventually, I think Roxy would tell you her colleagues did in the end, and she would tell them exactly what she thought too along the way. Anyway, that's what I learned when I one of the things I learned anyway when I read Chris Sweeney's book. Chris is a journalist, an author. His new book is titled "The Feather Detective: Mystery, Mayhem, and the Magnificent Life of Roxy Layburn." And I hope you'll join in the conversation as we move along today. Maybe you've had a chance to read it. Maybe you haven't. I know I have a lot of listeners interested in birds and feathers. And I hope you'll join in with your conversation. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Chris Sweeney, thank you for joining us today. It's going to be a treat talking with you.
Thanks so much for having me. Thrilled to be here.
How did you first discover Roxy Layburn, the woman this book is about?
I write a lot about birds. I report a lot about birds. And in 2016, around then, Audubon Magazine sent me out to Ashland, Oregon to visit the National Fish and Wildlife's Forensics Laboratory. It's this amazing place where they do all types of forensic analysis, be it ballistics, genetics, or morphology, to investigate wildlife crimes. And I was there to profile then the man who was in charge of the ornithology work there was a guy named Pepper Trail. And, first night I met Pepper, I kind of just asked him, I said, hey, you know, how did you get into this field and how did you even learn this was a thing? And he started telling me the history and he mentioned all this whole field of forensic ornithology traces back to a little unusual woman at the Smithsonian named Roxy Layburn. I wrote the name down, stuck in my head, thought it'd be a good story idea, did some poking around on the internet, found out she was at the Smithsonian for a long time. There were some archives. But then I kept reporting for Audubon, doing stories here and there. And a few years after meeting Pepper Trail, Audubon sent me to the Everglades to write about invasive reptiles, those giant Burmese pythons we hear about, and what they're doing to birds. And those things are devouring birds. But it turns out, take a dead bird out of a snake stomach, it's really hard to identify what kind of bird. It's just a big muck of feathers and guts. And so one of the researchers in Florida mentions to me, yeah, you know, we often send our bird remains up to the Smithsonian to be ID'd by this woman named Carla Dove. And I was like, Carla Dove is a great name for a woman who works on birds. So I gave her a call, and I had not talked to Carla Dove at that point. And she said, hey, where are you calling from? I said, I live in Boston. She said, you know, my mentor, a woman named Roxy Layburn, the first case she ever worked was an airplane crash right in your backyard, right in Boston Harbor. And at that point, everything kind of just felt a little serendipitous. And I became really committed to learning more about Roxy and her story.
Well, I'm telling you, you have a very entertaining and lively story. It is such a fun read, because you kind of cover her whole life. And at the same time, I'm sort of reminded about a lot of things like the Smithsonian itself and how it got going and the plane crashes and so forth that were taking place back in the 60s, which kind of led to some of her work. So it's really a fascinating story. How did she, maybe let's start at the beginning with her a little bit. She grew up in, she was born in 1910. And she lived a long, long life. But growing up, she was in rural North Carolina and was the oldest of 14, I think, siblings.
Yeah, something about that, including three consecutive sets of twins. So she came from this massive family. They lived in rural North Carolina. You know, they weren't poor, but they weren't wealthy, you know, kind of middle class at that time. Her father was an auto mechanic at the kind of the dawn of the motoring age. And so she had this kind of mechanical brain, I think. She had an engineering kind of mind. She also loved nature. She would, as a young girl, she would just go hike through rural North Carolina all the time. She was asking her grandmother for help identifying birds. But then in, you know, around college, she went to Meredith College and she started becoming pretty obsessed with aviation. She even cut class one time to see Amelia Earhart come into North Carolina, and she got busted and got scolded by the dean for doing so. But so she wanted to fly. She wanted to be a pilot. And her dad wasn't crazy about that and figured out how to kind of put the kibosh on her going to ground school to learn how to fly. So she, you know, kind of kept at it. She maybe thought she'd become an engineer, but she was also turned out to be a pretty good taxidermist. And one of her first jobs out of college was unpaid, but she was working at a small North Carolina museum preparing specimens and doing taxidermy work. And that's kind of how she got into this.
It's an amazing story. And to become... to become an ornithologist, the first forensic ornithologist, I mean, that, what did that mean at the time?
It didn't mean anything. You know, this was not a field that existed until Roxy really started pushing it. And what had happened was she got pulled into this world, like I had mentioned, with the airplane crash here in Boston. 2 years after that, another airplane goes down over Maryland. That one was caused by swans that hit the airplane while it was about 5,000 feet altitude. Swans nailed the rear of that airplane, caused it to essentially break off the tail, and that plane went down, killed everyone. So Roxy started figuring out these ways of taking, you know, the tiniest bits of bird feather. Imagine a bird feather being sucked through a jet engine, what you're left with. It looks like pocket lint. Yeah. Birders have a hard time identifying birds that are perched in trees that are living in, you know, fully well birds. And Roxy figured out a way. She started looking at the microstructures of feathers, these tiny little things called barbules. And she figured out patterns, and she could say, hey, this is a gull and this is a hawk. So she started developing this method. And most of her early work at that time, you know, focused on airplane strikes and birds getting hit by airplanes. But then somewhere along the way, the Smithsonian has this rich history of working with federal agencies to help, you know, whatever it is, whether it's the FBI or Department of Agriculture. And someone came to Roxy and said, hey, we've got a murder victim, and a woman put a pillow over her husband's head and pulled the trigger. We need to show that the feathers from the barrel of the gun match the feathers taken out of this poor guy's skull. Lo and behold, Roxy could do it. And then criminal cases started piling up, and there was more murders and kidnappings. And that's kind of how she became a forensic ornithologist.
Oh, man, it's a great story. Let's back up a bit. When she got out of, because I think it's really interesting that how the whole thing got set up. When she graduated, and by the way, and this we'll get to this later, but she was also did some drama, which had an impact later on. We'll talk about that as we move along here. But she started working as an unpaid employee at the North Carolina State Museum.
For 5 or 6 years, she was unpaid. This was not a big museum, but it had a little bit of a payroll. And, you know, there's a lot of sexism. Imagine 1930s, 1940s. You're dealing with a lot of sexism if you're a woman trying to work in any science, pretty much any field, to be honest. But Roxy kind of saw this as an opportunity. She was interested in biology. Imagine getting your foot in the door at a museum and getting behind the display cases and figuring out the art of museum making. And this was a real opportunity to do that in North Carolina. So she committed herself fully to this. And at some point, her boss said, all right, you can do some freelance taxidermy work on the side to make some coin. But, you know, we're not paying you. And then eventually, after many years of this unpaid, we'll call it an apprenticeship, but even that's maybe being a bit friendly, the state appointed her, and she was the first woman taxidermist to hold this type of position in North Carolina. And that was a big deal. The pay was still crummy, but it was a big deal for her.
Yeah, and she had to live, so she made the money on the side by doing a lot of other things. I mean, she was working like it felt like 24 hours a day. It wasn't, but it felt like it as I was reading.
You know, this is something that anyone who tried to train under Roxy, and there were a few people that successfully trained under Roxy, but anyone who knew Roxy talked about her work ethic to me. And I'm talking, you know, 10, 12-hour days, 6 days, 7 days a week. She was often in the Smithsonian on Saturdays and Sundays. A lot of this feather identification, you know, she was pioneering this, and it took a long time to prepare the specimens, get them under a microscope. She'd have to wander through the Smithsonian's giant collection looking for, you know, maybe this is a shrike or maybe this is a horned lark. So she had to pull all these specimens, prepare the specimens, do the slides and comparison. This was slow, tedious science that she just ground it out.
She did indeed. We're talking with Chris Sweeney today about his book, The Feather Detective, Mystery, Mayhem, and the Magnificent Life of Roxy Laybourne. Questions, comments for him, give a call. The number's 800-642-1234, or you could email us, the email address, talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you with us on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. We're talking with Chris Sweeney, journalist and the author of the book, The Feather Detective, Mystery, Mayhem, and the Magnificent Life of Roxy Laybourne. Give a call with your own thoughts, questions, comments at 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. One of the things I loved about your book were some of the side stories that pop up, one of them relating to the Smithsonian. And I don't know, either I'd forgotten or I never knew it in the first place, how the Smithsonian came to be. And I think that's worth a comment.
Yeah, this was one of the more interesting kind of aspects of researching this book, right? I have been to the Smithsonian as a child. Even later in life, I went and visited it a few times. It's such an institution, but many people don't recognize the history of this place. And really what happened was there was a British guy, James Smithson, quite a bright scientist. You know, this goes back centuries, though. He never set foot in the United States. He made a small fortune. He came from an affluent family over in the UK. And he was a bit of a bon vivant and kind of going around Europe and having a good old time and doing a lot of research. He was an analytical chemist, smart guy, made a fortune, dropped dead in Italy. And in his will, it said something to the extent of, you know, he's going to leave his fortune to the United States to found an institution for kind of educating and dispersing science throughout the world. And this baffled a lot of people. A lot of people all over in the UK, you know, didn't want this fortune leaving to come to the colonies or to the United States, former colonies. And there was some kind of contention in the US Congress over whether we should take this money. Some senator at the time said, you know, this will just, you know, we shouldn't be taking money from whippersnappers like this. And it's just a crazy little history of this place that helps educate so many Americans nowadays and does such pioneer, you know, supports so much brilliant research, to think it all came from this man who never even stepped foot into our country. It's a remarkable origin story.
And it was a pile of money.
It was. It was about, I believe, 2% of the federal budget at that time, which if you think about that in scale, it is a remarkable sum.
And the goal was collecting everything, including bird life, animal life.
Yeah, the Smithsonian's collections are vast. If you look at the Smithsonian now, it's really more than a dozen museums, and you could find everything in there from priceless artwork to, I believe there's a Confederate soldier's boot, all types of quirky bits of history. But the bird collection is remarkable. It's hundreds of thousands of specimens. And these specimens are really important. They support researchers. Researchers come to the Smithsonian every day to utilize, whether it's, you know, going into the insect collection or the tick collection or the bird collection. This is a very valuable research for scientific research.
And she landed after what, 5 or 6 years? Where, how did this all work out? I think did she go with the U.S. Fish Commission first, or
she
I'm
was,
trying to remember.
She was doing a little bit of work on Pivers Island, which is little island, Barrier Island off North Carolina. But she got called up to the Smithsonian, or landed at the Smithsonian, because essentially World War II had siphoned off a good portion of the Smithsonian's workforce. A lot of the men went overseas. And at the time, their bird collection was falling into a state of disrepair. They didn't have the hands to, you know, prepare specimens and repair specimens. And so one of Roxy's mentors or professors down in North Carolina had a connection, knew the Smithsonian needed a taxidermist, and kind of floated this idea to Roxy. And she pursued it. She got to Washington, D.C. and found that the bird collection was in rough shape. And so she started repairing some of these bird specimens. And, you know, there was one that she found. I believe it was the bird was stuffed with caribou fur. So somebody, you know, must have prepared it in the field and had some caribou sitting around. So they just stuffed it in the bird. And another one she recalled opening up and finding an artist palette knife. And she could never figure out if it was a cruel joke on the artist or somebody just got confused and left the palette knife inside the stomach of a bird, but never could figure that one out.
And she was really good at taxidermy. And I think you said something like, or you reported that she, in her year, her first year, she did something like 369 birds.
Yeah, she could crank through these specimens, it seemed, a lot faster than most. And she was laser focused. And I think part of the laser focus came down to the fact that she had walked into a boys club, right? This was men with taxidermy fleshing knives and exotic animal carcasses and arsenic and all types of chemicals, surrounding them. So it was certainly kind of that masculine environment. And Roxy fit in, but she was focused, and she wanted to outwork her peers, and I think she did, and she certainly impressed her manager in the first few months. I found a kind of gushing letter about how she was breathing new life into these specimens in the Smithsonian.
And she was married at that time. The marriage wasn't going well.
The marriage was not going well. She had married a guy in North Carolina who turned out to have quite a drinking problem and was nowhere near as ambitious as his wife. And I often kind of thought about the dynamics of being in a relationship where your wife's the breadwinner. And, it was kind of dark. I found an oral history with one of her colleagues at the Smithsonian who recalled Roxy coming into work with bruises on her body. And this was not a time when people would talk about this, but this man was concerned and really had some choice words about Roxy's husband at that time. She left him. That was the good news, is she got away from that guy and went out on her own.
Yeah, and wound up with another guy.
Wound up with a fellow Smithsonian taxidermist. and I think much to both of their surprises, ended up pregnant in her 40s, much later in life, out of wedlock. Her second son came along out of the second marriage. And she really loved this guy. E.G. was how he was known, E.G. Laybourne. And that was true love, I think, Roxy. And I talked to some of her proteges who, Roxy didn't talk much about personal life, but they all knew that was really her partner there.
Yeah. And it was this, I think he was in his 60s and she was 40 or more. So it had to have been quite a surprise.
Very much so.
when that youngster came along, You write that Roxy's move to the Smithsonian was from a regional museum was kind of like a ball player from Double A farm team getting pulled into the starting lineup of the Yankees. And they didn't, the taxidermists, as I recall, they had decided before she got there that they that she should be housed in the, something about the size of a closet.
Yeah, they really didn't want her coming into the taxidermy studio. Roxy recalled this in one of her interviews that, you know, on the first day there was all this sticker in a storage closet up on the, you know, third floor. They just, it was a masculine kind of place, and having a woman in there was going to cramp their vibes. But it turned out they all ended up loving Roxy, and Roxy loved those guys that she worked with for the first few years there. They formed this really special relationship, and Roxy was just one of the boys, so to speak, after a while.
Well, I think she proved herself to those.
Absolutely. Yeah, she really showed that she could do the work and do it better than a lot of the men surrounding her.
Do the work, keep your mouth shut, and they will respect you.
That mantra, man, she lived by that for maybe a little too long. And then I think she got confident and old enough to break out on her own and not keep her mouth shut so often.
Let's talk more about how she became an authority on feathers. What was it about feathers that fascinated her?
You know, she had spent so much time in the bird collection. And when you're in that environment, you're handling is at the Smithsonian, you have access to probably 90% or more of the known species in the world. So she was just constantly handling birds from all around the world. And you do that, you start to get a feel for feathers. You start to see details that you'll never see through a pair of binoculars or a spotting scope. And so she had this understanding of bird anatomy and feathers, but it really wasn't until this airplane went down in 1960 off Boston that it all clicked together. And they said, oh, we need to start understanding what birds are getting hit by airplanes. And one of the kind of steady pieces of evidence we have is feathers. And that's where Roxy, that's where her obsession began. And I just like to note, she was 50 years old at that time. She was 50 years old when she started working on feather identifications. I hope we all are able to take on new challenges at 50, because that just blows my mind.
It blows my mind as well. And you kind of had a little sidebar, sort of, on the airline industry at the time in the 60s, where the emphasis was on pleasure and so forth when you got on the plane.
Yeah, I think safety came second in those days. You know, we're all accustomed to getting the lecture of, you know, where the exits are and how to blow up your vest should something go wrong. I think they were popping bottles of champagne and really making it a customer-centric experience. This was the tail end of the golden age of flight, where travelers were a bit spoiled, but airlines were also dealing with some serious safety issues at that time, let alone all the hijackings. You know, this was a totally different age of flight. And so there were some, you know, a lot of safety problems with some of these airlines. One of the airplanes, the Electra that went down in Boston Harbor, they couldn't figure out if it was birds at first because the airplane had suffered an enormous amount of crashes, including two in which the wings just ripped off mysteriously midair and plummeted to the ground and killed everyone. So this was, you know, the golden age of flight, but maybe not the safest age of flight.
Yeah, and there wasn't at that time, to begin with at least, there wasn't a lot of thought that birds really created much of a problem.
Not at all. The military knew this a little bit. The military had done some projects on Midway looking at albatrosses that were sort of a hazard to some of their pilots. But the commercial airlines were not paying attention to the bird threat. The FAA was in its infancy, certainly wasn't paying attention to the bird threat. And even after this bird strike in Boston, they kind of chalked it up to a freak accident and said, look, you could replicate this scenario 100 times and that airplane's not going to go down. The engines will come back in time. And then 2 years after, you know, right after that Boston investigation was closed, another airplane went down, that one because of the swans, totally different circumstances. And I think at that point, regulators realized, birds are way bigger of a threat than we realized, and we need to do something about this.
And she was tasked with figuring out what birds were causing the problem. And as you said, I mean, she'd look, she would look at birds that they had on hand there, but then she got studying the feathers themselves and the barbules.
Yeah, so if you look at a feather, hold one in your hand, and you can kind of see it's a branching pattern. It has a main kind of line running up the rachis, and then it branches out. And then when you put those under a microscope, you pluck off a little tidbit of the tip of the feather barb, and that's where you'll put that under a microscope, and it's remarkable. There's all these cell junctures and pigments and little hooks and villi. It doesn't look anything like a bird feather, to be honest. You start to think, this is what my eye can't see. Under a microscope, a bird feather is a very remarkable thing. And that's where Roxy, made her payday, essentially, was figuring out, hey, all these microstructures are distinct among different families of birds. So, how the pigment aligns, or how these cell junctures align, or these nodes and villi, they're all different among different families. And Roxy figured out kind of a mental algorithm, actually, to start recognizing the patterns in these microstructures.
Yeah, you've got some cool photos in the book of those barbules. They're really fascinating. And you're right. They don't look at all like a feather under the microscope.
Yeah, you see those microscopic pictures and you're thinking, this is a bird feather? How could that be? But That was what Roxy stared at day in and day out, and really learned everything about them.
The occasion came up finally for her to be presenting, be an expert witness, and talk about those first, I think the first couple.
Yeah, so she started getting called into courtrooms, and these were for some violent crimes. I'm talking murders, suffocating by pillow. A person got, poor woman up in Maine was suffocated. The pillow burst and sent feathers all over the crime scene, and the murderer took off, but they found some feathers on his clothes. Another was an assault. And then there were some also tragic airline crashes. A loon went through the windshield of a Learjet and decapitated the poor pilot. And that became a lengthy piece of civil litigation that Roxy was called in to be an expert witness. So she had to take the witness stand under some high pressure circumstances. She was often grilled by defense attorneys who were trying to undermine her science or paint her to not be this expert, but just, some pseudoscientist, will say. So Roxy had to learn how to stay on her toes while on the witness stand and, deal with what was being thrown at her, which she could never anticipate.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting that the first couple, she was sort of all the facts, and she always stayed with all the facts, but the manner that she presented those facts was she thought about that. I think she lost the first two, went sort of the wrong way, and then they probably should have gone. But she drew on her back to her college days at Meredith College.
She was in the theater troupe at Meredith, and she loved it. And I even found an old review of She Stoops to Conquer, I believe, is the play that she starred in, and it got a very favorable review back in the 1929. But anyways, as she started testifying in court under these high pressure circumstances, she went back to her acting days, and she said to herself, you are an actor up there. Just put the mask on and get the message across to the people that need to hear it, the jurors and the judge. And so it was, be truthful, be concise. Don't show off how much you know. That was something she was really big on when she was on the stand. Don't try to make your, they don't need to know that you've done all this great work, Roxy. Just focus on getting the message across and the evidence explained in a way that they could digest it. And so she went back to her acting days and kind of got herself in the right headspace to put on these performances.
And I did you ever figure out how many that she did? How many times she, I don't remember reading that.
No, I don't know how many times she testified in court. I highlighted, you know, the ones that I could find, and there were certainly ones that I found that were maybe just not as interesting, or I couldn't find the corroborating material. And there's also maybe a few really exciting cases that she talked about in these oral history interviews that I found that I just couldn't find the corroborating evidence in the news. And once she claimed that she went undercover at a Boy Scouts jamboree to kind of inspect feathers to make sure, you know, that they weren't using any feathers from protected birds in their arts and crafts projects and trafficking. And I was like, I have to find this. Did Roxy really go undercover at a Boy Scouts jamboree? I could never corroborate that. So it's not in the book. And I still think about it.
You mentioned the Learjet, and that was in 1981. She identified a common loon as the species that crashed through the windshield of a Learjet, killing, actually it was the co-pilot, I think, pilot, because the pilot somehow managed to land with a horrific scene just to his right.
Yeah, that's true. That's, you know, that's a horrible case.
A horrible case. And the guy who was decapitated was a young guy, married, with one or two kids. And so there was a trial. And the significance of the size of the loon was interesting. Tell that story.
Yeah, so they needed to figure out how much this bird weighed, because that was the crux of this lawsuit was, you know, this did the airplane's windshield meet certification standards? At the time, I want to say, the time this Learjet came off the production line, according to the court documents and court transcripts, there was no standard. The Learjet of this, you know, there was no regulation stipulating that a bird had the windshield had to withstand a strike from a bird of 4 pounds or 8 pounds or whatever it was. But the defense attorney was really going after Learjet on its windshield. And Roxy said this was an enormous loon. This was, according to Roxy, this was a common loon that weighed 11 and a half pounds. She believes it had beefed up for migration. It was, you know, in the fall, so it aligned. She found lots of fat on this bird. She got a fair bit of bird remains to analyze in this case. There was a lot of fat. And so Roxy and Learjet's attorneys were arguing, this was an 11 and a half pound bird. This is about a freak accident as you can imagine. And the defense attorney, the attorney for the family, was saying this was not an 11 and a half pound bird. This was a much smaller bird, maybe 4.5 pounds. And so Roxy got hammered on the stand on that. That was one of the most brutal cross-examinations she underwent, was testifying. And this was a top-tier attorney, litigator that the family had bought in. And he really went after Roxy on this case. And Learjet lost. Learjet did not win that case. They said, you know, nope, Learjet was at fault. They awarded $1.5 million to the family, I believe. But what struck me is I found one of the junior attorneys in that case. And she said, you know, Chris, I have this very clear memory of waiting in the hallway after that decision was rendered. And I asked a few of the juror members if they would talk to me. And lo and behold, according to this attorney, all the juror members believed Roxy. They believed that this was an 11 and a half pound bird. They just couldn't fathom giving the family nothing. And so they ruled in favor of the family and not in Learjet. And that really irked Roxy, really irked her. She never got over that.
Yeah. And well, in the first place, she had she couldn't believe that they wouldn't believe her. Especially given the person who had said it was 4.5 pounds. Who had nothing like the experience she had.
Total lack of ornithological experience. But, you know, I can kind of, if I put myself in the juror's shoe, I understand that quandary. This was a tragic accident, family grieving, wife pregnant at the time that this poor pilot was killed. But, man, Roxy was so upset that the jury ruled against her kind of science. And she said that was it. I'm never doing civil litigation again. And I believe she stuck by it. I don't think she ever did any civil litigation after that.
Yeah, I think you're right. You talked about her work on saving whooping cranes. You know, we have here the International Crane Foundation in Wisconsin. So cranes are often on the minds of our listeners. But talk about that whole story surrounding hooping cranes, hoopers.
Larry, I love this story because Roxy never really talked about this. And when she was asked about it much later in life, she downplayed it and said, oh, I just played a small part. What happened was, early 60s, whooping cranes are in perilous situation. They were really teetering on the edge of extinction. There were very few left in the wild, very few in captive breeding programs. And so U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service wanted to figure out how to improve their captive breeding efforts. No one knew how to identify the sex of a whooping crane at that time. Was it a male or female? So Roxy gets called in to help with the whoopers, and they say, hey, we think there's a way to get up in the cloaca, and there might be some determinants of sex there. So Roxy started first working with sandhill cranes before moving on to whoopers, and she created what was dubbed a cloacoscope, which was kind of a way to pry open the cloaca. And she determined that you could see this pea-sized oviduct on females and these kind of bumps on males. And she spent a long time working on this. She traveled around the country. She visited zoos to work first to refine her sexing technique on cranes. And then she went out west to practice on live sandhill cranes. And then she finally gets to Texas, where there was a whooper in captivity. And she sexed that and did it, was able to confirm it was a female, I believe. And then she goes to the zoo in New Orleans that had the most whooping cranes in known at that time. And the guy wouldn't let her touch his cranes. He was this bombastic zoo owner who kind of had some luck with a captive breeding program, but he wouldn't even make time to talk with Roxy, wouldn't come out and speak with her, blew her off the entire time. She had to return to DC and say, I couldn't do it at the New Orleans Zoo. The guy just wouldn't let me touch his cranes. All this happened, and then Roxy validated her method, though. She wrote a report on this, an internal report for Fish and Wildlife. She developed this cloaca scope so that she could actually see up the bird's cloaca where the sun doesn't shine and get a real good look at the anatomical structures that she determined were sexing whooping cranes. And then I found this press release from Fish and Wildlife at that time, kind of never mentioned Roxy by name, didn't mention a female, just said a young scientist has developed a method for identifying the sex of cranes. And I was like, oh my God. This is remarkable science. And like I said, all these years later, she's asked about it in an oral history interview that the Smithsonian was doing. She just downplayed it. She's like, I played a very, very small part. And I beg to differ, Roxy.
And just to go full circle on the cranes, there was a female crane that finally got mated with another male.
And Roxy helped identify this crane sex, and it was misidentified. I can't remember off the top of my head if it was a male that was misidentified as a female. But this Roxy's work identifying the sex of the single crane changed the breeding program. It became one of the most prolific progenitors of cranes, and it lived a very long and healthy life and sired numerous offspring. And Roxy was the one that determined the sex of that crane.
It was an amazing story. She often had to deal with people her superiors, so to speak, at the Smithsonian. There was one guy who just didn't like her, despite all of her work. Talk about that a bit.
Yeah, this was a common thing. Roxy butted heads with middle management, we'll say. And this one in particular guy, Clyde Jones was his name. He wanted Roxy out of the museum. He didn't respect her work because in his eyes, the Fish and Wildlife Lab within the Smithsonian, this was about intrinsic ornithological research. And Roxy was doing service work. This wasn't real science. This was Roxy just helping airlines and police and, sure, might get some media attention, but this is not PhD level publisher perish type science. And Roxy didn't have a PhD. She never did earn her PhD, and that irked her a little bit in life, but she certainly made her contributions to science. So she butted heads with this guy, and unbeknownst to Roxy, actually, some male colleagues rallied behind her because the guy was trying to truly force her out of the museum and said, Roxy has essentially set up an illegal laboratory here to do feather identifications. She has no right. She should only be working on systematic red-winged blackbird research. And these three ornithologists kind of rallied behind Roxy and said, her work is essential to the FAA. And oh, by the way, she's always helping Smithsonian anthropologists and other Smithsonian researchers who come across bird feathers in their line of work and need to identify them.
Yeah, and her position was weird because they eliminated the position somehow, but she still got to stay there.
This was something that confounds everybody. No one ever really knew who Roxy worked for. The situation was she was hired by the Smithsonian in the 1940s, but soon after, a few years after, transitioned to a Fish and Wildlife employee. So she was a Fish and Wildlife employee within the Smithsonian. Then she gets fired from Fish and Wildlife, sort of, and goes to a three-day work schedule to focus just on the feather, to help the Fish and Wildlife agents who needed help with feather identifications for criminal poaching cases. And then she was also freelancing at the time and doing work for General Electric and Rolls-Royce and the engine makers who were developing airplane engines and needed to know how their engines, you know, ingested birds. So Roxy had this real piecemeal employment situation that she kept totally mum because she didn't want anyone, she didn't want scrutiny. She had a family to support. She was a single mother at this time. She had to do what she had to do, but man, did she have a strange employment status.
I loved it. What, she get what, $250 per consult or something?
Yeah, that's, I found some invoices, and I can't remember if it was for GE or Pratt & Whitney, but it was from one of the engine makers, and she was charging about $250 a pop for a feather identification at that time.
Amazing story. How has aircraft design changed since Roxy started investigating plane-bird collisions?
Yeah, you know, this started soon after those first crashes caused by birds in the 60s. So engine makers started figuring out they needed to make their engines more resilient and capable of ingesting large amounts of birds and large birds. FAA started improving some of its regulations around the weight of a bird that the aircraft needed to be able to withstand. But really what I think Roxy's most noticeable contributions are is if you go to an airport today, if you're at a big airport, you're very likely, you'll never see it, but there's a team of people working to keep birds out of flight paths. And I just wrote about this for The Guardian this week. I spent some time in Boston hanging out with the team whose job it is to keep birds out of flight paths. So they have air cannons buried in the grass, and they'll walk out if they see some gulls congregating near one of the runways. They can fire off an air cannon and woof, this big air blast comes out and the gulls go scattering. They have shotguns in their truck if that doesn't work. They keep, you know, really, really diligent landscape maintenance. You don't want to plant a bush that's going to start bearing berries at an airport and attract flocks of hungry birds that are going to come for the berries. You want to keep your grass short. You want to make sure there's absolutely no standing water near the airfields that are going to attract birds. And understanding what birds are being struck at an airport allows the airport managers to kind of tailor their approaches to dealing with birds.
Yeah. And despite that, there are still, I think you noted in 2022, there were something like 17,000 bird strikes.
Yeah, some more recent data has come out since, but 2023, 19,000 bird strikes at roughly 800 airports in the U.S. And I should emphasize to listeners, most of these bird strikes go unnoticed. They cause no damage whatsoever. But every once in a while, as you know, Captain Sully had to deal with, you know, these bird strikes can cause chaos and put passengers and pilots at serious risk.
She also dealt with, and she did a lot of work with the military, because
Air Force
that
still depends on her, or not on her, but on her protege. So the Air Force, the Navy, I mean, these pilots are sometimes flying single engine air. So you lose an engine there, you're in deep trouble. There have been some really tragic, unfortunate accidents that the Air Force has lost service members because of bird strikes. This is no laughing matter for them. I like to have fun, and I think Roxy's story is so entertaining. And in talking with some of the Air Force guys during this reporting, man, these guys so appreciate Roxy's work and the ongoing work of the Smithsonian's Feather ID Lab. They have, you know, when they strike a bird, they have to send in for identification. There were some really bad, including a B-1 that was struck by an American white pelican, and half the guys on that flight died. And there was a tragic accident in which a big jet taken off out of Alaska hit some Canada geese and went down and killed every member on board. So the Air Force takes this issue very seriously.
And there was even an astronaut, I believe.
Ted Freeman, 1964, during a training flight, first astronaut to die, died by a bird strike. And where did those bird remains get sent? Up to the Smithsonian for Roxy to identify.
So she started at the age of 50, and she was still going at, what, 90?
Yeah, at 90. She was working from her couch. She had her proteges. She had a few women working under her, but she was still, you know, her eyes were bad at that time. Her back was real bad, but she would almost listen to the descriptions of someone talking about the feathers that they could see under the microscope and talking about the barbules. And she's, oh, that's a gull. And she'd get up and wander over to the microscope, shuffle over to it. And she worked almost until the day she died.
It's amazing. And she loved her. She loved her work. She loved the animals. But she was peculiar in a lot of ways. She loved this horse, for example.
Oh, the horse story is just a remarkable story. She had a few horses. She lived on a nice piece of property in Manassas, Virginia, maybe 15, 17 acres, had a few horses, one in particular named Star. And her granddaughter told me this story, but I heard it from a lot of people. Star passed away, and Roxy was sad about it.
Well, she slept with it or laid with it the night it was dying.
Yeah, she really was a companion. This horse and her had this relationship. So she took her blanket out to the stable and stayed with it on the nights it was dying. And when it came time to bury the horse, this is how the granddaughter tells it. Roxy found, you know, kind of walked the property, found a place to bury the horse, dug the hole herself, dragged this horse over, put it in with the, dragged it over with the tractor, got it in, and then realized she hadn't dug far enough and the horse's legs were sticking up off the ground. Now, most people that love their animal like that say, oh, I gotta dig deeper. Roxy got a hacksaw out, and being a taxidermist all those years really paid off. She knew how to took those, clean the leg, clean right off, just saw through the horse's legs, called it a day.
And she was honored eventually. She received some nice honors for her work.
She did. She really became recognized both among her places of education, so Meredith College, George Washington, all alumni awards. At one point, I found some court transcripts in which she bragged about how the FAA and a few industry members gave her kind of a lifetime recognition award. But importantly, I think, is her legacy really stands out among people that know the threat birds pose to aircraft. And so here, you know, when I was talking to the Air Force guys who had known Roxy, man, does her legacy live large with some of these guys. And she got the due. I don't know if she got the recognition she deserves. I hope this book helps get her story out there and, you know, really cements her legacy. But among those who knew Roxy, she was really well respected and loved.
And how's the reception so far for the book?
Beyond my dreams so far. You know, it's been named one of the best books of summer by LA Times and Elle Magazine and NPR. And it seems to be resonating with readers because a lot of people love birds. A lot of people love science. And you put those together with a character like Roxy at the Center. I think it's a really intriguing book, and I think we all are better off from knowing Roxy's story.
I agree with you, and you've done a wonderful job writing about her. And thank you so much for taking time to be with us today, Chris. It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Absolute pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Chris Sweeney, a journalist, and the book is titled The Feather Detective. Take a look at it. The subtitle, Mystery, Mayhem, and the Magnificent Life of Roxy Laybourne. Great to have him with us today. And it's, of course, it's always great to recognize our team. Clara Nyper, Joel Patnod, Lee Rayburn, and Jeff Robbins. Our executive producer is Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller. Thank you for listening, and stay with us. Lots in store here on WPR News.